Robert Lava.
I heard so many things about it, I thought I had a comment.
Okay, terrific. Welcome to the world of fraud, Ira.
Yes, I'm with you.
Okay, we are on Daf 51, Daf Nun Aleph, Amud Aleph 51A3 in the English. 51A3. A slightly different subject is going to now be raised. I want to move along tonight, by the way. I want to get through the next Mishnah. So it may require a little bit of of rushing, so please forgive me, but there's a reason why I want to get through that Mishnah, because it's topical. Okay, Itamar is a discussion that is among the Amoraim. Okay, so this is going to be a discussion where the Amoraim will raise a point that has not been said before. There will be Breitot brought in order to establish whatever that point is going to be, but it will be an independent thought. Ha'omer l'chavero al menat she'en l'cha alai ona'a. Rav amar yesh lo alav ona'a. U'shmuel amar ein lo alav ona'a. Okay? If a person says to his fellow, this is somebody who is selling something. That's the context here. It doesn't have to be that, but that's the context. The person is selling something to somebody else. And he says, as he makes the sale, or before he makes the sale, Al manat she'en lecha alai ona'a. This sale is on the condition that you have no claim of price fraud against me. Right, now we see that the law of ona'ah is a basic law. We've learned that both the buyer and the seller have recourse. So the question is, what if a stipulation is made and accepted? So the stipulation is made by the seller, accepted by the buyer, that in this case, ona'ah won't apply. Now the assumption being, of course, when the person is buying from the seller, he's not expecting to be defrauded. He's not expecting to be defrauded. But from the seller's point of view, the seller wants to be sure because you can never be sure in these things. One of the problems of this system is that every time you make a sale, you could be subject to recourse. And somebody could either ask for some money back or really undo the sale. So the seller might be tempted to say, all right, I'm willing to make this sale to you. I think that, as far as I know, this is perfectly fine, but I'll make the sale only with the stipulation that ona'ah doesn't apply. Can he say that? Is it permissible to say that? It's an interesting question. So here you have two different points of view. Rav amar yesh alav ona'ah. Rav says, even if you make such a stipulation, the buyer has the right to claim ona'ah. Okay? The stipulation is no stipulation. Right? It's an illegal stipulation. The buyer has right to ona'ah because where does he get the right from? From the Torah. Okay? The Torah gives him the right. The Torah sets up ona'ah. So he says, Rav says, yesh alav ona'ah. Even if you stipulate that the sale is made without the potential of recourse to any price fraud, it's no stipulation at all. Yesh lo alav ana'ah. The buyer has a right to claim price fraud against the seller if it's warranted. If it's warranted. Just as we said before, there is a time frame for that, and you know all those things still remain the same. The strange thing is, Shmuel amar ein lo alav ona'ah. Shmuel says that if you've stipulated and accepted the stipulation, that takes precedence, and ona'ah does not apply. To tell you the truth, the one that's intuitive here is Rav's position. How could Shmuel ever take this position? How could it be? Okay. So the Gemara is going to have to analyze this now. Now realize, the time frame we're talking of, Rav and Shmuel are the first generation of Amoraim. Okay? So this is now the generation, after the Mishnah. After the Mishnah. Rabbi Judah the Prince edits the Mishnah. One of his students was Rav. Rav is a Babylonian. Studies in the yeshiva in northern Israel, in the Galilee, then goes back to Babylonia. Shmuel is a Babylonian. So it's your first generation of Babylonian Amoraim who are raising this issue. Okay. Now, the strange thing is that what the Gemara does next is that the Gemara says that there is an issue of principle that divides Rav and Shmuel. And that issue of principle, we can even see if we look at another baraita in a totally different area of law. But it's a baraita. Now remember, baraita has greater force of law than a discussion among the Amoraim. So it's not infrequent that a dispute between two Amoraim will then be submitted to another dispute. That is to say, this dispute is really not our own dispute, but it's like another dispute which we have in a baraita between two rabbis of the Tanaitic period. And that's what happens here. Okay. Lei marav di amar karabi meir ushmuel di amar karabi rabbi Yehuda. Let us say, now when the Gemara sets it up like this, you got to get ready for problems. You get ready for trouble, because the Gemara says, Lema, let us say. Anytime it says, let us say, at some later point, it's going to be, but maybe we could say the opposite. So you know that that's going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet. All right? And what's going to happen now is going to be so reasonable that it's hard to imagine it could happen. But believe me, the Gemara is going to do it. Okay, so let us say, or here the English says, shall we say, it's also a good way to do it, that Rav has the point of view of Rabbi Meir, and Shmuel has the point of view of Rabbi Yehuda. D'tanya, as it says in a baraita, Homer la'isha, a man marries a woman, or this is the act of marriage. What does it take to marry a woman? You have to give her something worth pruta, and you have to say Hare at mikudeshet li b'tabat zokadat Moshe v'Yisrael. You don't do that, you're not married, unless you do another thing. But that's we learned last year, 2 years. We spent 2 years on this. That's the classic statement of marriage, right? That kesef is kone, that through a monetary transaction for consideration for a contract, that's how you make a contract. And this is consideration for the contract. Okay? So a man says, Omer l'isha, Harei ad mekudeshet li. Here, behold, you are betrothed to me. Almanat she'ein lach alai she'er kesut fa'ona. With, on the condition that you shall have no claim upon me for she'er, kesut, and ona. She'er is food, clothing, and marital relations, sex. Right? So this is a marriage of convenience. He doesn't want any obligations. There must be something in it for this guy. But he wants to make sure that she doesn't make any claims against him. She doesn't make any claims. She has no claims for sex, no claims for food, no claims for clothing. Now, the reason that this is an issue is that those claims are based on the Torah. The Torah itself in Parshat Mishpatim says, Sheirak suta va'onata lotigra. Good for you. You shall not hold back from her she'er, which is food, ksut, which is clothing, and sex. So that's the basis of Jewish marital law. It's right there in the Torah. A man is obligated for those things. So the question is, the Torah says that he's obligated. He says to her, I make the following stipulation. If she agrees to it, Is it possible for her to agree to that? Just as here. What did the Torah say? The Torah said that you have a law of hana'ah. Two people say, all right, there is a law of hana'ah, but we agree that we will forego it. Here it is. The bride says, you normally, yes, the Torah says that you owe me this, but I agree to forego it. Can she agree to forego it? That's the question. So here is what the bride says. He says that. Says that, and then goes over to the next page. No, it starts on the previous page, sorry. Hare zo mikudeshet utna'o batel. The woman is betrothed, but the condition is nullified. Okay? So in other words, when he makes that condition, it's like he said nothing. Essentially, he said nothing. So he did say, Hare Amakudeshetli. He said that. That's enough. If he then puts in a stipulation that's illegal, the stipulation is illegal, so that doesn't apply. But the first part of it did apply. So she's betrothed, but he still owes her all those things. Right? Even if they agreed not to do it. All right? So that is Divrei Rabbi Meir. That is the point of view of Rabbi Meir. Okay, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Bidavar shebemamon tna'o kayam. Regarding a monetary matter, the stipulation stands. In other words, according to Rabbi Yehuda, a monetary issue is different. So realize that there were three things that the Torah required. The Torah required food and clothing and sex. Food and clothing are essentially monetary matters. So those things, according to Rabbi Yehuda, stipulations can be made about, even subsequent to the Torah. Even subsequent to the Torah. The third one, the sex, is not a monetary matter, and therefore you can't make such a stipulation. That's an illegal stipulation. But according to Rabbi Yehuda now, monetary issues are potentially agreeable between the parties, even if the Torah says otherwise. Okay? Now, there is a concept here which is a very basic part of Talmudic law, which is not brought in the commentaries here, which is that in the world of affairs, courts can always develop new procedures for buying and selling. And therefore, this is an ongoing area of the development of the law, which in fact can supersede something that's said in the Torah. It's possible. Simply because it is understood that the courts have absolute jurisdiction in monetary matters. That actually gives even Shmuel the right to say that there is so much flexibility in monetary matters that as far as Gentile courts go, Gentile courts have valid jurisdiction in monetary matters where there is no Jewish jurisdiction, and that's acceptable in Jewish law. That's a real issue as far as living outside of the land of Israel goes. Because the question always was in the diaspora, whether the decisions of a Gentile court must be abided by a Jewish court. Because you have two different legal systems. No matter where you were, if you were in Europe somewhere, anywhere in Europe, you have a legal system, you have a Jewish legal system, and you have another legal system, however it was constituted. Question is the one incumbent on the other? Surely the non-Jewish system wouldn't accept the validity of a Jewish legal system. Question is, what about the other way around? The Jewish system have to accept the non-Jewish system. The understanding is that the nature of commerce is such that commerce is ideally a universal reality, and therefore that commercial law, first of all, commercial law by a Gentile court and the decision of a Gentile court has equal validity with the decision of a Jewish court. That's why, for example, This was a big issue about, what is this? This is now, it was about 4 months ago. 4 months ago. This was the issue of the Syrian Jews. Syrian Jews from Brooklyn. Who were involved in a money laundering in New Jersey. Who had summer places and deal. There was money laundering there. And the question is, are they subject to a Gentile court? Does a Jew in his monetary transactions have to abide by the law of the state? Okay? It can't be a question because the law goes according to Shmuel. Shmuel says, Dina de Malchuta Dina. The law of the state is the law. And that applies not in all areas, but it applies certainly in all the areas of commerce. It applies in all monetary areas. Okay? Could be other areas where it wouldn't apply. They have to be examined. But as a general statement, they always apply to monetary issues. So you cannot say that, well, the laws of money laundering don't apply to me because we don't accept the laws of the Gentile state. According to the Talmud, according to Shmuel, they do. So there's a certain independence. I'm just giving you this as an example to note the fact that monetary transactions have a certain independence to them. They are dealt with, they almost force themselves into the realm of the universal, and they are therefore unusually able to continue to develop. Generally speaking, that's not the case in Jewish law. In family law, for example, very conservative family law. But in the law of monetary transactions, very different.
Was this money launderer trying to assert that Jewish law would allow it? I mean, I don't understand the argument even.
I don't think that it would.
No, that, I don't know that he was trying to assert that, but he was trying to assert that that an argument could be made that the laws of the state simply don't have jurisdiction.
So he would sit in jail without approving that.
Do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
He can say whatever he wants.
Well, particularly since he felt that there was a valid purpose. The purpose of this was to pay for the yeshiva.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Correct.
Yeah, but that's
well, not necessarily anything goes, but a lot of things go. A lot of things go. There's far more latitude. Well, of course, that's illegal. I mean, it's illegal in every way. It's illegal Jewishly, it's illegal, as well as being illegal from the laws of the state. But forget the laws of the state. Jewishly, it's illegal. Okay? So, again, I raise this only to introduce the notion here that that monetary law is frequently somewhat different than other laws, such as family law. Okay?
So doesn't that make our whole discussion of Ona'ah sort of irrelevant if we go by general law anyway,
if
we don't go by the religion?
Well, that's true. In fact, you couldn't use the law of the state to force somebody to give you back money. You couldn't do that. Not outside of a place where there was clear jurisdiction of Jewish law. For us, it becomes a matter of ethics and not law. Because there is no force of law here. You're right. Once you don't have jurisdiction, you have no force of law. But the ethics still are the ethics. And that's what it interests us. The fact that there's a claim of the buyer, there's a claim of the seller, all of that is to introduce, number one, honest transactions, and number two, to create a market. Issues of the market continue to exist right down to our own day, to create a market that functions. And a lot of this is really designed to protect and develop that market. So even though the laws may be somewhat different, many of the laws still have the same goals. The laws against insider trading, for example, try to do the same thing that is being done here. So, yeah, you don't have jurisdiction, but the concepts are nonetheless, I think, applicable. Yeah.
This is a whole other aspect here. It's one thing to talk about a purely commercial transaction and what applies there. But within, we're talking about here a marriage relationship, or a potential marriage relationship, support, sustenance. That's not a pure commercial issue. That's a family issue.
Hold on for just a second here, because I think you're immediately sensing that these are not the same issues. Yeah, you're absolutely right. and frequently you'll see this in the Talmud, because the Talmud will say, well, this is just like that. And then the next thing that's going to happen is, yeah, this is just like that, but this is not just like that. you got to see that there's a basic difference between them. And we'll have to see what that difference is. It could be you are going in one direction, that family law is different from monetary law. That's certainly a reasonable way to go. Talmud's going to go in a slightly different direction, but end up in the same place. Yes?
I see another reason why the parallel between the husband and the wife is not the same as the commercial one. Mm-hmm. Because if the husband requires that the wife make that, stipulation, then the wife could become a ward of the state, and the whole community might have to support her if the husband no longer provides clothing and food. So that could be why they, you couldn't do it in that situation.
It could be, but remember now that Rabbi Yehuda is saying that you can do it. So that's odd. We would expect that he would say you can't do it, but he says you can do it. Okay, let's go on. All right, now the Gemara takes this argument between Rav and Shmuel, and it says, originally it said, just get the train of thought here, it said, you might be able to say that the two different points of view which we have between Rav and Shmuel are analogous and parallel to two different points in a Baraita, the difference between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. So it showed us how you might say that. The very next thing is going to say, but having said that you might say it, I'm going to tell you why you can't say it. All right? Amalach Rav can say to you the following, Amri the Amri of Filil Rabbi Yehuda. The point that I made would even be true according to the view of Rabbi Yehuda. Remember, he was going according to the point of view of Rabbi Meir. So he's saying, it would even be true according to Rabbi Yehuda. Ad kan lo kama Rabbi Yehuda hatam ela diyad av kamachala. As far as Rabbi Yehuda's position that he stated, that is, that a stipulation contrary to what is stated in the Torah is effective only because... Wait, I'm trying to read the English here. For thus far, Rabbi Yehuda stated his position there, that a stipulation contrary to what is stated in the Torah is effective. Okay, that's what Rabbi Yehuda says. Only because in that case, she knew of the obligation, yet forgave it. Okay, the wife, Rabbi Yehuda says that if the husband and the wife do make the stipulation, it's still valid. So how could it be valid? Well, he says it could be valid because they both knew what they were talking about. When he made the stipulation, she understood exactly what he was talking about. He says, you're not going to get any clothing. You're not going to get any food. And she knows what that means. It means she's not going to get any clothing. She's not going to get any food. So how is that different from the other case? Aval hacha, but here, in the case of fraud, miyada de machil. Does the buyer know that he is forgiving the fraud? When a buyer enters into a transaction, he assumes it's a reasonable transaction. If he knew that it was an unreasonable transaction, he wouldn't have done it. Okay? The assumption is that when a buyer and a seller are engaged together, that the buyer is expecting that there is no fraud. Then if it should turn out that afterwards, in fact, he paid too much, well, then he has recourse. But ab initio, he doesn't go into it with that. He has no assumption that he's being defrauded. We're giving him a possibility after the fact of finding out that he's defrauded, but he enters into this assuming he's not going to be defrauded. The wife, she's entering into it, accepting the stipulation, and knowing that in fact the stipulation will happen. The buyer doesn't expect it to happen, because that's not the way the thing works. The buyer expects everything is hunky-dory. It's just if it turns out that it's not, he has recourse. He has recourse. So that's the difference between the two. Ushmuel Amar, and Shmuel could say, Amri Amri Afilil Rabbi Meir. what I said, that a stipulation that there be no claim of price fraud is valid, is true even according to Rabbi Meir. Ad kan lo kama Rabbi Meir hatam ele devadai ka'akar. Interesting point. For thus far, Rabbi Meir stated his position there, that a stipulation contrary to what is written in the Torah is void only because in that case the stipulator definitely uproots what is stated in the Torah. Okay, the stipulator, the Torah says that you have to give a woman these things. The Torah says it. So the guy says, I'm not going to give it to you. So it's very obvious that what is being said is the contrary of what the Torah says. Right? But here, in this case, who says that he uproots anything? Right? The guy, just because there is a stipulation here, is no certainty that it's ever going to happen. There's no certainty that it's ever going to happen, because the likelihood is that this is a valid transaction. Or else he wouldn't have entered in. Neither party would have entered into it. So, when to begin with, there's no obvious effort to uproot the Torah here. The assumption is that the Torah won't be uprooted. Okay, it's not a great point, but look at note number four. I think the point is good. At the time the stipulation is made, it is not certain that it will conflict with the laws of the Torah. Okay, because if the transaction is fine, there won't be a problem. Won't be a problem. For perhaps the agreed upon amount will not turn out to be inflated. Although, as it turned out, the item was overpriced and the transaction did contain ona'a, this was not clear at the time the stipulation was made. Right? That's what we said. The seller, therefore, did not intend to uproot the Torah. The issue is, therefore, one of intent. At the very action of the seller is not designed to necessarily uproot the Torah. Right? Because he didn't have that intention. He had the intention simply of selling the item and to selling it at a valid price. So he had no intention of uprooting the Torah, because he's just trying to create for himself a backup mechanism.
Less headache.
What?
Less headache.
Less headache, right. He doesn't really want to uproot the Torah. He's not trying to go anything against the Torah. But he knows that the more headaches he has, the more he has to worry about people coming back to him, the harder it is for him to engage in commerce. Okay, so that's all he wants to do. The seller, therefore, did not intend to uproot a Torah law. Apparently, whether a stipulation is considered contrary to the Torah is not determined by whether it is objectively contrary to the Torah, but by whether it is known to be contrary to the Torah at the time it is made. Okay, that's the difference. So it's not whether it's objectively contrary. It's whether it's known at the time that it's made that it is in fact contrary to the Torah. Okay? So I don't find that to be too compelling an argument, but it is correct. I mean, I understand the point of view. Yes.
So this is the statement that you just read. So we don't need to have this final sale or this condition at the trade, because if there is no intent to go against the Torah, why to come to this position of condition?
Because just in case, if it should work out contrary to everything that I expect, I would like that to be the case.
Yeah, but if there is no hidden motive.
Yeah. Was no hidden motive to, at the time, necessarily go against the Torah. It could end up that it will at a later time.
Let's say there was a motive and there was a final sale with the condition, right? So it doesn't catch anyhow. So
no, if there was a motive, then it would be different.
It's on eye anyhow.
What do you mean? Oh, it doesn't matter what the result is. It matters what the intention is. You're saying that the results are the same. You're correct. But we're saying, or at least the Gemara is saying, and I'm not trying to emphasize this too much because I don't like it.
Okay.
But the Gemara is saying that the intent is what's crucial. And that all of this really depends upon the intent.
And how do they determine what the intent is?
Well, it's No, it's. I don't think that that's necessarily wrong, because they say that when the sellers, most sellers simply want to sell things, and they're not necessarily engaging in fraud. They just want to move from one transaction to the next, because that's their business. That's their business. And the problem is that the law creates impediments to the normal transaction of commerce.
It slows it down,
and it makes headaches for the seller. So that, you know, we have this frequently in commercial things. Small businesses don't want to have all kinds of paperwork. You go to a doctor, and the doctor today has to spend a tremendous amount of his time and his money dealing with the insurance company. That's a real headache for a doctor. That's not why a doctor is a doctor. But that's what we force doctors to do. That's the way we've created this wonderful system that we have, right? Which makes us so healthy. But if it were so great, there wouldn't be a national debate right now about what's wrong with the system. So it could be that everybody has good intent, but the system that you create is a pain in the neck. And that, in a way, could be Shmuel's position here. Shmuel is essentially saying, yeah, fine, okay, but it's a pain in the neck, so let's just, there'll be a limited number of cases where, in fact, there is clear intent to do wrong. Okay, but otherwise, we're just not going to have a system that functions properly. Okay? Amar Rav Anan says, Lididi miparshali mineda mar Shmuel. It was explained to me personally by our master Shmuel. Right? He was a student of Shmuel's. And so he has the teaching of Shmuel, and he understands the ramifications of it. Ha'omer l'chaveiro. Someone says to his fellow, Al manat she'en lecha alai ona'a. If he creates the following stipulation, on the condition that you have no claim of price fraud against me, ein lo alav ona'a. He has no right to claim price fraud against him. Al manat she'en bo ona'a. On the condition that there is no price fraud in this transaction, hare yesh bo ona'a. There is price fraud. So he explains, a student of Shmuel says, depends on the way you create the condition. Depends on the language of the condition. If the language of the condition is such that the person who makes the stipulation says, Ein lo alav ana'a, on the condition that you have no claim of price fraud against me, then he has no right to claim price fraud against him. So that's a valid stipulation. That's what we just read before. I mean, it's nothing new here. What is new is what comes up next. Al manacha in bo ona'a. But if the stipulation is not that you don't have a right to claim it against me, but on the condition that there is no price fraud in this transaction, that in a way is making a claim that you can't really know about. It's claiming a reality that you can never really be sure about. So if he makes that, hare yesh bo ona'a, the law of price fraud still applies. The force of this is that the student is sort of elaborating on what we've learned just in general terms from the teacher of Shmuel. So we're getting another detail. Shmuel apparently taught it in a more nuanced way. Okay. Meiteve. Now, Meteve is where the Gemara itself, among the Moraim, will take a Braita and then create a contrary situation. I'll show that a Braita is somehow opposed to some idea that we've already just seen. Hanosei v'anoten ba'amana. Someone who trades on trust, i.e., English is helpful here. One who hires an agent to sell his merchandise for him and trusts him to get the best price he can. It's a very interesting case here. A seller is not selling directly to the buyer. Instead, an agent is between the seller and the buyer. So let's say that the agent sells for too low a price. Does the seller have a claim against the agent? Right? Somebody is doing his bidding. Agent is doing his bidding. The question is, does ona'ah apply there? Right? Because if you trust an agent, you expect the agent to do what you would do. But the question is, does the law of ona'ah apply directly to an agent? So, hanoseva noten ba'amana. If one trades on trust, i.e. when it hires an agent to sell his merchandise from him, trusts him to get the best price he can. And of course, the agent tries to get the best price he can. But he can come back to the original seller and he says, you know, I got the best price I can. So the seller says, the best price you can, you could have gotten twice the price. So who's right? It's a very difficult position if you're the agent. Because let's say the guy is doing a good job. He's doing whatever he can. But you know, when you have an agent and he doesn't do it the way you want to do it, you wonder whether you have a claim against him. Right? So somebody has this agent and says to his fellow, on the condition that you have no claim of price fraud against me. Ein lo alav ana'a. He has no claim of price fraud against him. Okay? The agent can very well say, I'll be your agent. But you can't claim any ona'a against me. Because I'm trying to do the best I can. And I will only be your agent if you tell me that you're not going to make a claim against me. Otherwise, I don't want to be an agent. I don't want the job. I'm going to do the best that I can. And I'm going to be there. You're not going to be there. And you can't tell me afterwards what a price I should have gotten. So in fact, the Gemara supports the agent. The bright thing is support. Ein lo alav ona'ah. He has no claim of price for it against him. All right. If the agent says that, then in fact, the seller has no claim of price fraud against the agent. That's a reasonable thing. Now, we just learned a moment ago, though, that there's a point of view that says that you always have a claim of price fraud. But here we see a case where it says that you don't. And the Braita says that. Eino levona. L'Rav Diamar, according to Rav, who said, An the Amrei Afile L'Rabbi Yehuda Hamani. Rav, it was who said, what I said is valid even according to Rabbi Yehuda. Rav, remember, was the first one. Rav said that you can't stipulate to get rid of Ona'a. You can't make a stipulation to get rid of Ona'a. So here he says, Rav, according to the Gemara, was that even according to Rabbi Yehuda, I can go along with this. Hamani, who is the Tana of the Baraita? Who is teaching this Baraita, which surprised us when we read the Baraita? Amar Rabbaya Michavarta Rav Amar Karabi Meir. This makes clear that what we originally thought was true, Rav stated his view consistently only with Rabbi Meir. We read originally Rabbi Meir's view. Rabbi Meir's view was that you can't make a stipulation against the Torah. You can't do that. So that was the point of view of Rav. And even though you said maybe Rav says that you can, the answer is you can't. And that what we originally thought Rav said is what he means. And don't, you know, again, here we are in the argument. We said, you might say, and then I said the next thing is, you might think you could say, but... And in effect, we're coming back to note the way we originally thought is probably the way it was. He meant what he said. And don't say that it could have been according to Rabbi Yehuda and so on. Okay? Amar Rabbi Mechavata Rav Amarka Rabbi Meir Ushmu El De Amarka Rabbi Yehuda. So it is what we said. Rav has the point of view according to Rabbi Meir in the marriage case. And Shmuel has the point of view according to Rabbi Yehuda in the marriage case. Okay? And the difference there was, as we had said it originally, that it was probably going against the Torah or not going against the Torah, where financial matters are independent. Okay? Amar, Rava Amar, Rava says, Lo Kasha. No. The middle piece here, which where we said maybe, you might say, and now we're showing that maybe you shouldn't say it. This is Lo Kasha. This is not difficult. Kan Bistam. This is an important issue now. Kan Bistam. In the case of Rav's ruling, we discuss where the overcharge is unspecified. Kan Bimefaresh. Here in the Baraita's case, we see where the seller specifies that he is overcharging. Now, look at this next Baraita. This is an interesting case because you have actually raised this case here in class. The Tanya. In what case was this law said? Namely, the law of Ona'ah. In what case is the law of Ona'ah applicable? Bistam, where the overcharge was unspecified. Where the overcharge was unspecified. Aval bimefaresh, but where the seller specifies. For example, and here it gives an example. Mocher she'amar lalokeach. If a seller says to a buyer, Chefet ze shani mocher lecha b'matayim. This object that I am selling to you for 200. Yodea ani bo she'eno shaveh ela maneh. I know it's only worth 100. Right? That's very explicit. The seller is saying, I am overcharging you for this. But I am selling it to you with the stipulation that you cannot claim any price for it against me. Okay? Eina lavona. In fact, price for it does not pertain there. Because the buyer and the seller both agreed on this price. They agreed. And he said ahead of time, I'm overcharging you. I am definitely overcharging you. And I will only allow this transaction to happen if you have no claims against me. So in this case, the Baraita says he has no claims. V'chein lokeach she'amar lamocher. Likewise, a buyer said to the seller, Chefet ze she'ani lokeach mincha b'maneh. This item that I am buying from you for 100. Yodea ani bo she'shave matayim. I know that it's worth 200. Al manat she'en lecha alai ona'a. But I'm buying it on the condition that you have no claim of price fraud against me. Ein lo alav ona'a. There is no claim of price fraud.
It's going to be the marriage, you know.
Let's just be clear what this is saying. So what it is saying is that the law of price fraud is bistam, namely, most transactions don't take place this way. Most transactions, we don't say, you know, that one is overcharging, undercharging. That's not the way it goes. That's not the nature of a transaction. So that's bistam. Bistam means it's just a regular transaction. But if you can think of a case where somebody can explicitly state that there is going to be an overcharge, and that is accepted by the other side, then that's valid. That holds.
So I think that's a little troubling. Mm-hmm. What would be the situations in which you would want to ask for the stipulation of no subsequent claim of price fraud? I can think of two main situations. One is the example you gave before, where you're trying to simplify the transaction. You're trying to eliminate paperwork. Mm-hmm. And then that's sort of benign. It's sort of in everybody's interest. The other situation is where one party has power over the other. Mm-hmm. And it can, in effect, force the other person to accept the stipulation. And it seems to me that the situation that's described here is exactly... The situation that's described here is exactly the situation where one party has power over the other, because he can reveal, I'm overcharging you. But I'm still going to sell it to you at this price because you have no choice, and I'm going to insist that you waive your right. Mm-hmm. So this seems to me like exactly the situation where you wouldn't, because you want to protect the weak party mm-hmm. from waiving this right which is protecting.
Well, that's an interesting question. Whether you can protect a weak party from waiving his rights.
Isn't that the whole reason to insist on some rights not being waivable?
It doesn't have to be. It could just be somebody who... I have a usual guy comes around Wednesday and buys these things from me. But I really want them today, and I'm willing to pay you more. Yep. I'm willing to pay the premium. I really want this. So, I mean, it's not always... I mean, I'm not disagreeing with the scenario you established, but there are times when somebody is willing to pay a premium for something, for whatever reason they have.
Ron, just talk to us.
Mm-hmm. All right, and Ron?
No, I said every airline is doing it and make you sign. You cannot buy tickets on Christmas time and pay the price you will fly after February. You know, it's double the price. I bought
those
tickets
to Dublin. Those are different products.
The advertising say $189 flying, and I signed for $1,031 for the same flight on Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve. And they know it, and it's on the same page of price list.
Uh-huh.
And I have no protection.
Okay.
I understand my husband's point about the potentially coercive position of a seller who owns the stuff. But I see also, and I think that there might be protection in this for the buyer, where it's sometimes useful, as you're saying, to buy something at a higher price, knowing that you're doing so. But there I think that maybe it's not ona'a, because in reality, the value of the item is worth more than the stated price.
That's correct.
So if it's snowing out and you need a shovel,
right,
the value of the shovel is
greater.
That's
correct.
You know, same with the Christmas
lights.
The
question is, can a seller take advantage of the time-sensitive issues?
Well,
that's the question, and this is the intent.
But
ona'a.
That's what I'm saying.
Sure.
The value then is really... It's different.
The market is different. At that point, you've got a different market. And it's because it's Christmas Eve, or it's Christmas, or it's 2 weeks before Christmas, that in fact you have a totally different market than you would have 6 weeks before Christmas, or 2 months before Christmas. It's totally different.
So it's not ona'a.
It's not ona'a.
Right.
Correct. That's exactly right.
We stipulate that it has to have a limited supply,
mm-hmm,
for this to apply, because in Ron's illustration, that's the premise.
Mm-hmm.
There's more demand than supply.
That's correct.
So do we have to now look to the conditions, mm-hmm, that would permit us to be comfortable where this could apply, that we could have a premium?
Mm-hmm. Could be. I don't know the answer to that, but that's
okay,
a good question.
Now
yeah,
we're trying to find,
you're right,
some pattern,
correct,
to make us comfortable.
Correct.
I think it's more time sensitive, well, rather than supply and demand.
I don't think your example fits, because that is the market, because that's what everybody's paying. What we're talking about here is somebody
who's,
well, that's...
No, are we talking here about someone?
No, check out the expensive ticket over a holiday is in fact what the market is, and that's not the premise of what we were discussing.
It's not the market. We don't have the opportunity to negotiate.
No, but I'm just saying, I don't view that as the equivalent of saying, I know this ticket over the holidays is worth $1,000, but I'm going to charge you $2,000. Because that's really what the
right
market is. So I agree with your position. I think this is really bad. And it's bad because, number one, the situation in which this really can occur is if somebody has cornered the market.
Right.
And in fact is now taking advantage of distorting the market by virtue of some other thing. And I go back to the way I like to think of this, which is that the transaction is three ways between the buyer, the seller, and God. And by that criterion, this doesn't pass muster to me,
mm-hmm,
in terms of these two people having the ability to essentially exclude God's moral judgment about this transaction just between the two of them, because I think it excludes the crucial third party's involvement.
Very good. Okay. Yes.
In all cases, without exception, the buyer has a choice not to buy.
Not always.
We don't know that. Let's think of an illustration where the buyer has to buy a coffin. I mean, that's one that comes to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Medications. Yeah.
Medications.
This does not only apply to overcharging. It talks about underpaying as well, where it's presumably a buyer's market. So it's not that kind of situation. I have a question, because there seems to be an inconsistency with what we learned earlier. And there are two things. Number one, we learned that the wronged party has the upper hand.
Correct.
In this discussion, it's reversed. The wrong party is forced, whether he's overpaying and buying, or being forced to sell at below market price, being forced to stipulate that he's giving up his right to claim Onaa. So he's, in contrast to what we learned about the law, which is the wrong party has a certain amount of time to find out what the fair price is, mm-hmm. whether he sold it to lower price or overpay. Here, what they're saying is, if they both agree to it, and it's openly stated that here's the situation, then the stipulation is valid, mm-hmm. which seems to contradict that notion. The other thing is, in the law of Onaa, I thought intent was irrelevant. Mm-hmm. It could have been just somebody didn't know the actual price. He didn't intend to overcharge or he didn't intend to underpay.
Generally, that's true. Correct.
So here, they're saying only in the case where it was intentionally done and stated that it was done, can a person be forced to agree to a stipulation where he gives up his right to make a claim?
No, you don't. You're not forced to agree to any stipulation. You have to. You agree to it willingly.
Okay.
You have to agree to it willingly.
I think in that sense, I think this discussion is valid. That you have no choice. You're stuck in a blizzard, as happened to me last year. And you find a cab, and for a $50 ride, he tells you $250 cash in advance, or forget about it. What are you going
to
do?
He takes you to a different town.
You have to do it. So, and these are cases where probably in the underpayment, the seller is desperate. He needs money to feed his family, where the buyer is desperate to get something he needs and cannot get it unless he pays. So it just doesn't seem to fit with the whole idea of the law.
Any other comment, dude? Ron, did you have?
In my business, I have a lot of situations, and there was a situation bankrupt once, the memory business in the United, in the all over the world. When memory was created, some companies.
What does memory mean? Chips?
The chips
are computers.
Computer, many, many years ago. Some companies, it was like for 1 megabyte you paid $1,000 or something. It was very expensive, and some companies saw it as an opportunity to cash on the market. So what they did, they said that we have 18 to 20 weeks lead time, and they generate speculation that people paid through their nose for their computers, and the memory made the computer very, very expensive. And then was a fire in Hitachi factory, in addition to that, which nobody knows the reason, and it completely went berserk. But then what happened, a lot of people who accumulate a lot of memory, and when production came, the memory went to like $50 megabyte. Many people lost all their year and a half investment in memory by playing the market. Mm-hmm. So their intention was to cash and make a lot of money. The way up, it was very good. But suddenly it changed, and all those who made a lot of money lost a lot of money. So all their profit went down. The only one in long term, the people like us, enjoyed the cheap memory. Now the memories are very cheap, and that nobody is doing the same game again. So it's a timing that I don't understand why it's justified to allow this to happen.
It's very interesting to me to hear this discussion, because so many of you are involved in real world situations. I think that the examples that you've brought are good. I think what it makes me think of is, I think we're tempted to assume that the purpose of the law of Onaa is to provide protection for people, that it's almost a price protection. And I'm never sure that that's really what it really is. Because I keep coming back to the thought that the law of Onaa is protection, not for people, but for the market. that it's really an issue of the market, and to some extent the market is cruel, and the market also benefits from lack of regulation. Well, I didn't say no regulation. I said, but that's the tension in the markets always is, would it be better to allow boom and bust because that's the best way to keep a market fresh, creative people coming and going, and to allow for that speculation which occurs once in a while, and that's just how it is, or is it best to regulate it and to make sure that doesn't happen? I'm not sure whether that's a doable job. Now, that's, I think, what you keep hearing all the time. Is it possible to regulate the market in a way that stops the boom and the bust kind of life in the market without almost killing the market? That seems to me what's being debated, I hear, these days. And I don't know the answer to that question, but I hear that that's sort of the nitty-gritty of the debate. To come back to this, the understanding of the Gemara, I think, moves from protection of the individuals to somewhere, the other side of that is protection of the market, which ultimately will be best for the individuals. And I don't know that there's a resolution to that. I'm not sure there is a resolution to it, because surely I haven't heard that resolution in a very intelligent society that debates this night and day. I still haven't heard the resolution to that issue. And every time I hear one side talk, it makes sense to me. I hear another side talk, it also makes sense to me. So I don't know the answer.
I think markets flourish when there's trust and transparency. I think that those are the key elements that allow people to be willing to enter the market.
What about freedom?
Well, I think that would go hand in hand with trust and transparency. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think but the way in which you ensure trust and transparency, there are several ways to do it. One is regulation and enforcement. The other is to be bound by a moral system. And in fact, it's often been said that the reason that the Jews were looked upon as very favorable choices for merchants was because they were recognized as having a moral system that bound them. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there are lots of ways to achieve it. Mm-hmm. But I think the real issue is whether you trust or not. And I mean, the seizure in American markets was the day people lost trust
exactly.
in the ability of the counterparty to be able to actually execute the trade. Mm-hmm. That's when markets can't tolerate, and then people act irrationally about not trading at all for those reasons.
Fastest growing economy in the world, which is going to overtake Germany. In Japan, is the next great economy is China. Would we agree that there's trust?
Which is a communist marketplace, am I right?
No, not a communist, but is there trust and transparency? I don't think anyone here could argue there's trust and transparency in China.
That's right. Why Obama's there. I mean, Obama...
To imbue trust and transparency.
We need to make sure that our money is well invested.
And where is there trust? First of all, transparency, that word has become very trendy, and it's meaningless because it doesn't exist. I mean, that's a nice concept.
I think that the boom and bust, the peak and the bottom, I don't think this is healthy for any business. And the Ona'a laws or any other regulation should change the ripple between high peak and low bottom to some little... You can have a little peak and a little bottom, but it should be regulated in a way that the ripple
right.
is not, in a way, destructive to the
too
market.
Too destructive, right.
So as long as you give freedom, as long as you have trust and transparency, and you have regulation, and you allow the ripple to exist, as long as it's not by the bend of complete destruction, then we maybe call it socialism, but it's still the ability to give the market to develop their business.
I think I understand that. And that's sort of where I come out with this, too, is that to assume that this has to be an absolute system that has to cover all cases, I'm not sure that it has to cover all cases, because it may be that you need something in the middle. You need a certain amount of cases. Most cases have to be covered, but there can be some cases where you don't interfere, and that there's a balance between those two, and that the balance is really healthy and not bad. The balance keeps the ripples at some tolerable level, and at the same time doesn't overregulate the market.
I don't know how things were then. I think one reason I'm reacting to this the way I do is 16%. We're talking about 1/6. It's just, why shouldn't I be able to? If I buy prepackaged chicken at Park East, as opposed to the Empire prepackaged chicken block away in the supermarket, that's a 50% difference in price already. The Empire is much more expensive. And so these price differences we're talking about, if I'm willing to pay 18% premium on something, I'm not saying that a person should be able to take advantage of a starving person who wants bread. But I'm saying to allow two business people to prevent them from entering into an arrangement over a margin this small in
the margin is twice
1/6. One more comment. Yes, you got the last word.
In the business world that I operate in, I think the driving force, whatever people would like, the driving force is profit. The thing that limits
these flavors and fragrances.
The thing that limits excessive profiteering is competition. So I will agree with you that in a free market, competition is what keeps the market stable. It can be disrupted by conspiracies to restrain trade, monopolistic practices, cartels, some price fixing. Right. This is where regulation comes in. We've got a ton of laws designed to prevent that. The fact that you have a 50% price difference between two vendors of essentially similar products says you have a choice in the marketplace. Good. They're not fixing prices, because if they did it, they would both be at a higher level. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest problem you run into is when either you don't have any laws to protect the market, or those laws are not enforced. We live in a society where those laws have not been enforced. And laws that have been on the books a long time, they used to be vigorously enforced. We actually have laws that prevent price gouging. You know, Robinson-Patman Act says you can't charge for a $2 product that you're selling to a mega company. You cannot charge $10 to somebody else. It's a $2 product. You have to give them the same price. Those laws are not enforced, as far as I know. So you can have a blindness company. You cannot really do it. So it's not that complicated. This idea that people have to have a stipulation, I'm going to overcharge you, and you can buy it from me, because I know you're desperate. You got to sign saying you're not going to suit me later, or vice versa. I know you're about to be evicted, your children are still hungry. I'll buy this from you, but I'm only going to pay 5 cents on the dollar, but please don't sue me. Those are sort of rules of the last resort, I have to say. It's not a question of transparency. It's a question of, and I agree with you, free markets work, but they only work when they're really
free.
Price fixing is not free market any more than having the state to set prices at a certain level.
Very good. Excellent. I want to go to the next Mishnah now. This is on 51b2. It brings up a totally different subject. Well, not totally different. And you'll see the nature of this subject is directly connected with what we've been talking about. We've been talking about laws of hona'ah, okay? Fraud. And strangely enough, from our perspective, you will see that in the Talmud, the laws of fraud apply as well to the reality of money, the nature of money per se. And I want to read through the Mishnah and see what the Mishnah says and then reflect upon what's going on here. Keep in mind that in the ancient world, just think, in theory, what is money? In the ancient world, money was something of clear value, namely gold or silver, and they had known prices. At a certain point in time, in order to create commerce, you didn't deal with big pieces of gold and big pieces of silver, but you turned them into coins. And they were known weights of gold or silver. The problem for the Talmud is that if the notion of money itself is that money is an identifiable amount which is connected with a weight of an object, it's called $1. And $1 weighs, let's say, 100 grams. Problem then is, what if, just given the physical reality of money, it loses some of its silver? And it becomes worth less. At what point is a dollar no longer a dollar? What if it only weighs 98 grams? Is it still a dollar? We are so used to a convention of money where money has, in fact, the things we call money have no inherent value at all. It's a symbolic system. It's an agreement. It's a system that functions on the basis of general agreement. That's my introduction, but let's read the Mishnah and then we'll reflect on this more. Okay? Kama tehe asela chasera velo yehe ba ona'a. How much can a coin lose at which point the person who was paid with that coin can say, this is ona'a? Right? You're paying a seller. So he's selling you something. And you give him a coin that no longer has 100 grams in it. It has only 97 grams, 96, 94, 90. At what point does the seller have an independent right to return this and say, I want real money? I want real money. I sold this to you for a dollar, and your dollar isn't really a dollar. Okay? So that's the question that Gemara is asking here. How much can the seller be missing? Veloya heba ona'a, till it gets to the point where it's considered to be fraudulent. Rabbi Meir Omer, arba isarot, 4 isars per seller. Isar le dinar, which is an isar per dinar. The key thing here, it's too complicated to remember these relative amounts. You'll see in note 20, they're all there very explicitly. But the good thing about the English translation here is that we are really interested in proportions. Because remember, in the law of Ona'ah, we learned that 1/6 was the crucial amount. You just made reference to that before. So here, the proportion is, according to Rabbi Meir, 1/24. So it's a more stringent system than the normal the situation of Ona'ah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, 4 pundion per sella, pundion dinar, which is a pundion per dinar, 1/12. So in other words, it's twice as significant a lack in the actual coin. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, Shmona pundiot, shnei pundiot ledinar. 8 pundiot or 2 pundions for the dinar, the crucial thing there is that it's 1/6. So you've had 1/6, 1/12, and 1/24. Okay? Those are the three possibilities here for the value of the money itself. And then you see the way it goes on. Ad matai mutar lachsir. Until when is it permitted for the defrauded party to return a defective coin and claim that it was unacceptably eroded at the time of payment? Bakrachim ad kadei shiare l'shulchani. In large cities, until time elapses for him to show it to a money changer. Because money changers know about money. And you have them in large cities. Right? Basically, you've got banks. Right? The banks are in the money business. Was that Willie Sutton said that? You remember Willie Sutton? Some of you don't remember. You don't know who Willie Sutton was.
That's where the money is.
Sutton was in the bank robbing business. They said, why do you do that? He said, well, that's where the money is. Why do you have banks? Sorry. Thank you. That's where the money is. Okay, so that's in large cities. Cities have banks. In the primitive world, cities had banks, and you didn't have branches of the Chase Bank, you know, in every little town. Bakfarim ad arvei shabbatot. In small villages, until the onset of the following Sabbath, because business is done, most business is done on a Friday. You can see this also, it's true in Israel today. It's true less so here, although, frankly, there are members of this congregation I see once a week on Friday morning. Because we all do a certain type of business on Friday morning. We're all going either to buy challis or to buy vegetables. It's all Sabbath buying. So I have friends that I know, and I have some friends from college that I see locally once a week. If our schedules are good, and if they're not good, it's once every 2 weeks. So we go, how is everything, you know, how these relationships that are Friday relationships. That's how it is in a small town. Im haya makira, if the one who passed the defective coin recognized it, afilu li'achar 12 chodesh mekablai menu, then even after 12 months, he should accept it back from him. Ve'ein lo alav et ataromet, and he has nothing against him but a valid cause for complaint. Vinotna lemaser sheni ve'ein choshesh. One may use it, namely, one may use all kinds of money for deconsecrating maser sheni. That's the second tithe. There is an obligation to give a tithe to the levy, and the farmer is also obligated in certain years to give a second tithe. That tithe he has to take to Jerusalem and then to eat the food in Jerusalem. But let's say he lives in the Galilee. How can he take all of his produce all the way to Jerusalem? I mean, the whole tenth of his produce, that's a lot of produce. So the Torah says he can cash it in for money. He then takes the money to Jerusalem, and there he goes to the King David Hotel.
And that's why we have price gouging. Everyone's with their money and they need to buy things all at once.
Well, correct. So the question is, in the money itself, when you have to cash in your crops for the money, what if it's not really the right money? What if the money is not such good money? Have you done your duty? Have you done your duty? And in fact, it's permissible. She'eno ela nefesh ra'ah, for it's only one of ungenerous disposition who refuses to take such a coin. In other words, it may be technical matters here. In certain practical matters, you also have to accept that there are things that you just have to do. Okay, there are types of transactions. In certain religious transactions where you can't be a stickler for these things. And if every time you were to handle a coin, particularly in a religious matter such as the tithe, you were to be worried about whether it was on or not, it would never work. It just wouldn't work. Okay, now I wanted to read this to you because I wanted to just discuss the subject of money a little bit. this Mishnah introduces the subject, and it's introduced in the same context, the context of Ona'ah. But I find that frequently for us, it's so foreign that it's worthwhile pondering the nature of money. We assume that money is basically a social convention, and that we have a convention, and it's to some extent dependent on a market. There's a free buying and selling of money. Because after all, how do we know how much money is worth? How much is the English pound worth in relation to the dollar, or the euro, or whatever? There's got to be a trading of money. Right? So there's a market for money which helps to set a price, and there is, in the separate markets, which are not part of the larger market, there is a certain level of social convention that is acceptable within the community of people. Okay? Most of the time. It doesn't work all the time. Because when, for example, a year plus ago, people began to distrust the system, where did they put their resources? They went into gold. And the price of gold has gone way up. The price of gold, I believe, still today is astronomical. The price of gold is astronomical today, reflecting uncertainty about other types of general agreements about the value of money. Because it's so dependent upon trust, and the community that functions on the basis of that trust, that when that trust is undermined, then you wonder whether you have anything. Or is this just a game we're playing? Well, the modern world, of course, is very dependent upon this. And there are problems even with the notion that there is a social convention of money, which it seems to me was probably the main reason why Mr. Obama went to China. Because the Chinese currency is not valued enough. The Chinese have artificially lowered the value of their currency. Why? Because they want to sell a lot of goods. And you can control your currency and make your goods more desirable because your goods are cheaper. So that you can, in a way, interfere with that market. And that's part of the nature of government, that government can have that control. Contrast that really to the notion of metallic money. For most of the history of the world, money was considered to be a metal. Even in recent American history, I'm sure many of you know this much better than I do, the desire to go on a gold standard, for example. It's a major issue in this country. It was in my lifetime. I remember when all dollar bills had backing to them. It's very recent. It's very recent that the money that we use is simply become a total symbol of something totally different, of this general agreement that goes on. In the world of metallic money, though, that was the world until fairly recently. And that's the world we're dealing with in the Talmud. It is the world of metallic money, where there was an acceptable value, an accepted value for things that were metals. And that value was at first measured by weight. And later on, there were also things put on coins, such as amounts. And the moment that you stop measuring by weight and you put an amount on the coin, you're asking for trouble. Because it's only a matter of time till the coin won't weigh that amount. Because that's the nature of coins. Simply the nature of the coin. So even in a system that seems to be a fairly stable system, it also has a problem. And that is precisely the problem the Talmud is going to deal with. Money was counted, coins were counted, and weights were very basic. But even the notion of clipping or sweating coins, this is a notion in money, is where in clipping you shave off some of the silver from the coin. Sweating coins, you take a bag full of coins and you shake them up. And eventually you get dust. You get dust. And that dust has come from the coins. And you then have the notion of good money and bad money. What we have come to say, for example, that bad money, how do you say it? Okay. It's Gresham's law. Gresham's law. Gresham's law is?
Bad money chases out good money.
Bad money chases out good money. What does that mean? What bad money means is that money that has lost a certain amount of its metallic reality becomes lighter money. It becomes lighter money. If you have money that is lighter and heavier money, what people tended to do was to hold on to the heavier money and to put that in their mattress and then pay their bills with the lighter money, which is what is meant by bad money pushes out the good money. It all presupposes a metallic reality and a reality where metals have a value which is more objective. I don't see how it could be completely objective, but it's more objective than the kind of money that we use, which is so much based on faith. Okay. So I wanted to give you that little bit of background because it's not intuitive for us since we don't function today in much that kind of a system. And yet it's so important, the way in which money works. It's so basic to our lives in terms of the economy of what's happened here for the last year plus. It's, I really think, basic to why Obama went to China. It's really to push the Chinese to value their money so that there can be fairer competition. And here I get back to my markets. Without that, we're in trouble. Without that, we're in trouble. Okay? Questions or comments?
What's the first thing that happens if you give somebody pay with cash now? What do they do with it?
Yeah, I see that. I see that's happening now. Why do people do that? Because they think it's counterfeit?
They've been taught how to see it.
The water bottle.
Is there so much counterfeit money to make?
And they also take that pen, which has a certain color.
Right.
And the other thing, talking about China and trust, just as an anecdote, but we deal with an office supply store. And if you buy a certain amount of goods, they send you this free thing, a tote bag, a mug, or something. So we got, last week, two insulated mugs, supposedly lined in stainless steel. And you plug them in, and they're on your desk, and they keep your coffee warm. So I look at this thing, and I turn it over, because it's made in China. And I look at this supposed stainless steel inside. Shiny. And I said to my receptionist, tell them we'd rather have a tote bag. I said, I think this is lined in lead. I said, I don't know what it is, but it's made in China.
I don't want to drink coffee from that, right?
And I don't want anybody to use it. Anyway,
okay.
Whatever that's worth.
Very good.
I'm sorry Bobby isn't here because a number of years ago, Bobby curated a show on money and art.
Is that right?
Artists have dealt with a lot of these issues in very creative ways. I'll just tell you two vignettes. So one is Keenholz created a series of paintings and painted on each painting a dollar amount of a different amount from like $10 up to $500 and then sold each painting for the dollar amount on the painting. as a way of reinforcing this issue of the lack of connection between intrinsic and perceived value. But the best is an artist by the name of Boggs. And Boggs made counterfeit money as an artist and different denominations, very high quality counterfeiting, but clearly not designed to be counterfeit. Of course, he would put his name as a secretary of the Treasury and a variety of other things. And it was obviously not a typical counterfeiter. And then he would go into a restaurant or into a hotel, and he'd buy something. And he would offer the proprietor either to pay for it or to give the proprietor one of these works of art, which was a bill. And the bill would be in a denomination greater than the cost of the item. And if the proprietor chose the bill, the proprietor had to give change, reflecting the difference between the stated value on there. And then he would photograph all of this and then sell the pictures of this transaction. And he actually was charged with counterfeiting. The feds eventually went after him. He's a real character. But in fact, it brought together this incredible nexus of the connection between intrinsic value, worth, and trust in ways that became really very, very
fantastic. Fantastic.
Very, very dramatic.
Friends, to be continued in 2 weeks.
Rabbi, I have a rhetorical question about a child who's money, which is a contract that didn't work.